Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The California promoter of Issue 2 this weekend released a documentary in Ohio to give voters a clearer picture of what he's proposing. He said he produced the documentary about the genesis of his AIDS-fighting organization to defend against an onslaught of attack ads against him and Issue 2.
There's a big technical aspect to running a healthcare system, but there's a big aspect of cheerleading and encouragement and empowerment. The human touch is still the essence of what we do. That encouragement that we give to people to get tested, to get treated, to adhere to their medications, to show up for their appointments, that is still, you know, the lifeblood of the organization.
Issue 2 would require that state healthcare programs such as Medicaid enjoyed the same prices for prescription drugs as those paid by the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. Joining us, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch, Daryl Roland. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be here.
And state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jesse Ballmer. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And also a reporter at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Andy Chow. Welcome back, Andy.
Good morning.
Okay, so this is the guy behind Issue 2 in Ohio. He's from California. He's released this documentary. He says he's going to spend, or his group's going to spend, about $62,000 just to air this in the six media markets in Ohio. I'm trying to figure out who's going to watch it, for one thing. But what does this have to do with the price of tea in China, Daryl Roland?
Well, he is, for better or worse, he's kind of become the lightning rod in this whole campaign. And a lot of it is due to the opponents of State Issue 2, again, the so-called Drug Price Relief Act. He's being demonized by the opponents. What's this California guy doing coming into Ohio?
Michael Weinstein, by the way.
Yes,
yeah.
Michael, not Harvey.
Not
Michael.
Harvey. Right.
You know, what's this California guy doing? What interest does he have in Ohio? There must be something nefarious and all that. My colleague Marty Schleiden talked to Mr. Weinstein, again, Michael, as well as some of his critics and supporters. And he's a different kind of guy. There's no question about that. So he certainly got an ego going here. He feels a real need to defend himself now. Mm-hmm. So I guess this little documentary thing is one way of doing that. But he's kind of a complex guy. On one hand, you know, hey, he's the head of an AIDS foundation. That sounds like a very noble cause. It is a noble cause. Spend lots of money battling AIDS. You know, who wouldn't be for that? But then he also throws his money in on some weird issues that some folks say. Well, for instance, there was a zoning issue in L.A. His critics say the only reason he was against it is because it would allow a high-rise to block his view from his high-story office. So maybe he's not quite the noble person that some would make him out to be. So as with I guess with most of us, we're kind of a mixed
Right, I was going to say, just
picture.
As small-minded as the rest of us.
Well, and, perhaps, but yeah. But you know, now both sides, there, you almost become a caricature of yourself during a political campaign.
Right.
So the opponents are trying to characterize him one way, and now he's gone for the other way.
And you know what? We've seen over the course of this campaign, we've seen both sides try to argue the facts about the issue itself. Is it going to lower the cost of drugs? Is it going to raise the cost of drugs? And it's really interesting to see how the rhetoric and the talking points have shifted from the issue itself
right.
to this one man. And I feel like that's probably a good sign that the opposition is winning as far as the talking points go, because that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to start to cause a stir and to make people ask questions. Well, who is Michael Weinstein? Why is he coming here? What's in it for him? And for Michael Weinstein to go on the defense over and over and over again, he had one teleconference on Thursday last week, and then all of a sudden the next day he decided to do it again because he, I guess, didn't make his point the first time around. He just wanted to keep going out there. And during that second teleconference, I don't think we ever really heard an argument for Issue 2. It was just an argument defending himself.
Jesse?
Yeah, I think it also speaks to people are a little confused by Issue 2 generally.
Never a good sign.
The concept of, you know, essentially Issue 2 would require state insurance such as Medicaid to reimburse for these for medicine and drugs at the same rate that the VA gets. Part of the challenge is both the VA and places like Medicaid negotiate down the prices of these things, and we're not exactly sure what those negotiated down prices are. So it's very hard to compare. So I think absent the desire to really dig in on some of the challenges that Issue 2 has, both sides have been going against, you know, the backers of Issue 2. Mm-hmm. So on one side, you know, Mr. Weinstein, and then on the other side, pharma, which is putting up all of the money for the opposition. So,
Daryl Rowland, why is this so hard to understand? I mean, when I just look at it on the face of it, they want to give the state of Ohio the same rates for prescription drugs as the VA gets. End of explanation. Or better.
Well, sounds good, but there's more to the story. Even if Ohio could do that, what are the ramifications? That's the argument.
The unintended consequences, you mean? That kind of a thing? Or
yeah. Yeah. And, you know, on the one hand, some folks say, well, okay, so this certain group, you know, and again, this is not for all Ohioans. This is just as...
All Ohioans, though, pitch in to pay. I mean, isn't there a bottom line here that as far as taxpayers go?
Well, taxpayer dollars, right. Sure. But as far as personally benefiting in prescription
right.
drugs...
That's not what this is about.
Exactly. Exactly. So there's a little, it's a little unclear. And the bottom line is we just don't know what this is going to do. This is a big experiment. This was on the ballot last year in California. Unfortunately, Californians defeated it, or at least we'd have at least several mm-hmm. months of experience of what happens on the left coast from this. Both sides are plausible. You look at the Office of Budget Management, the state bean counters analyze this issue, and they say savings are, quote-unquote, plausible, but far from certain. So even the experts, and these are pretty much nonpartisan experts, disagree because, this could happen, but that means X, Y, and Z has to happen. Or this could happen, but, that means A, B, and C could happen. So it's hard figuring out. You're kind of predicting the future here and a lot of unrelated things, how they're all going to work together and drug prices. How the heck are those calculated anyhow?
And Ohio's never been one for experimenting when it comes to ballot issues, right?
Yeah. And what I was about to say is this seems to be the trend for big ballot issues in Ohio. For the past couple of years now, we face these issues that are almost boiled down to, well, this is a good idea if it works. And it's not quite – it's not like anybody's here saying we don't want to lower drug prices. We don't want to make sure that drug prices aren't inflated. But it's – is there a process that can actually make sure that drug prices can stay at a low affordable rate? Just like when the medical marijuana issue went down, that was a popular opinion – but it wasn't crafted the way that people wanted it to be crafted. So I think we're seeing with a lot of these ballot issues, it's more of, is this actually going to work? Is this actually going to achieve what we want it to achieve?
You know, the big part, we kind of cast this in terms of putting Michael Weinstein on the defensive. So the numbers, whatever the polling is on this, must show that Big Pharma has achieved that and putting it, making it about him. He's putting out this documentary. But is it possible that Big Pharma went that route because just going the strict this won't save you money thing? I mean, they were having a hard time with that. It wasn't making the...
Well, it could be. And sometimes you attack your opponent where you are most vulnerable. I've talked to supporters of Mr. Weinstein, and they're saying, we are here demonizing this guy, this head of the AIDS Foundation. Now, again, for all his controversies, he's doing lots of good works. And some of the accusations being leveled at him for financial benefits and exploitation, well, those are the things that most people would attach to the bosses of drug companies and their bazillion-dollar salaries and bonuses and all that. So they are attacking Mr. Weinstein for the very things on which they are vulnerable. So that's sort of a popular political tactic. You look at 2004, John Kerry was attacked, for being like this
Swift
wimpy
boat.
Guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then they attacked him with those Swift boats, the Veterans for Truth and all that. They attacked him at a strength, and that became a controversy and perhaps somewhat of an effective one. At least muddies the waters enough.
Yeah.
And again, as you imply, Anne, and I think we all know that when it comes to a state issue, you know, it's either yes or no. When you're in doubt, very often you'll vote no.
And the interesting tactic with going after Weinstein is that, and Weinstein made this point last week, is that with the pro-issue two side, they're all out there. You know who the head of this is. You know who is leading the charge on the pro-issue two side. Meanwhile, the people who oppose it, we know that big drug companies are funding it, but we don't know exactly which drug companies are putting in the big bucks because there's this whole so-called shell game where they fund the money to an LLC and then that LLC funds it to the super PAC. So there's no way of tracing to exactly where the money's coming from. And so it's just another interesting point where the opposition to issue two can put a name and a face to it, and the pro issue two side can't really put a name and a face in a specific drug company. When they say big drug companies, they can't say exactly who.
Why did Weinstein bring this to Ohio? Do you know? Has he said?
So he has said that, you know, Ohio, it's a test market for everything, such as, you know, Wendy's and everything. So might as well test market your ballot initiative here, too. They're looking for a win in a Midwest state that they can say, look, here is Ohio, you know, the state that has some liberals and some conservatives. And if it works here, we can roll it out elsewhere. Whereas if it had worked in California, some might say, oh, well, that's California. They do everything differently anyway. So bringing it to a state like Ohio allows them to roll it out elsewhere if it passes here.
And has there been any polling? Do we know anything?
I haven't seen any public polling. There might be internal polls, but I'm always very suspicious of those.
Of course.
So, a lot of what we're talking about is, oh, based on this move, we think maybe this is where the polling is going. But we're not entirely sure.
Daryl?
this is a whole other issue, kind of the demise of public polling in Ohio.
Yeah.
I'm like Jesse, I haven't seen anything from an unbiased source, a university or a respected media organization, thing of that nature. And frankly, even if there were, state issues are just about the hardest thing to pull on. Because, you know, you put the especially if you're going to do a phone poll, it's not like you can read the entire ballot language.
Yeah.
So you end up reading like a title and it becomes, well, do you want cheaper drug prices or not? And, of course, everyone's for that, but there's a lot more to it. Are you for state issue two or not? It's like, well, duh. I don't know.
Yeah.
So it's notoriously hard on which to poll.
Yeah. So and even going back to medical marijuana, I think people thought because the concept of legalizing medical marijuana was so popular in Ohio that perhaps that ballot initiative would have done better than it did. But it did very poorly here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like Daryl said, when people are confused about a ballot issue, they tend to vote no. Mm-hmm. And I think what the pro issue two side wants is for somebody to ask themselves, what do they care more about, voting no for something that they're confused about or voting yes on something that can hurt big drug companies? And I think that's this big thing. Is it that you don't like big drug companies or that you don't like confusing ballot issues? And I think it's because nobody's been able to. It's not that people don't know what they want it to achieve. Like I said, they don't know. It's not that they don't know what they wanted to achieve. They just don't know if it'll work.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting. As Andy says, you look at the yes on issue two, folks, and their press releases are like anytime one of these big drug companies, you know, gets into trouble or there's a misstep or a fine or something, they're putting out a news release as if that is an argument for state issue two in Ohio. Now, who knows? That may be working. If you're going to demonize, you know, an AIDS Foundation head on one side, well, okay, we'll demonize right back on the drug companies because you've certainly given us a lot of fuel. And anyone who saw 60 Minutes last night or saw the Washington Post over the weekend, amazing expose of how drug companies use their influence to avoid regulation from the DEA, friends in Congress and revolving door from federal regulators to the industry and just... First of all, just from a journalistic point of view, just having 60 Minutes and Washington Post team up, very powerful in and of itself.
But, is that related to the opioid story in today's Dispatch?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Where
it's a pickup. Yes.
Someone wanted to pull in the reins on the drug companies and start to monitor more closely how they're dispersing opioid drugs, and they got those regulations changed.
Right. They were saying essentially, this is very, very simplistic, but hey, you're being too mean to these drug companies. You know, they're good, solid citizens or whatever. And of course, this hits home right here in Columbus, Ohio, with Cardinal Health being one of the three largest drug distributors in the country. Mm-hmm. Their name came up a lot in the Washington Post and was 60 Minutes last night. So they're involved in it too. And as well, you know, and this blends right in with a lot of localities are suing drug makers and drug manufacturers. Attorney General Mike DeWine has done the drug makers so far. He hasn't done the distributors like Cardinal Health, but others like the City of Dayton and various local entities have included them.
We will continue with our weekly reporters roundtable. Still with us, you just heard from Gerald Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, also Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Jesse Ballmer of the Cincinnati Enquirer. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio State has officially denied a request from white supremacist Richard Spencer to speak on campus. Spencer gave OSU and the University of Cincinnati a Friday deadline to allow him on their campuses to speak. Otherwise, he'd sue. The University of Cincinnati on Friday agreed to allow Spencer to speak. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. Joining us, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch, Gerald Rowland, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer, Jesse Ballmer, and reporter at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Andy Chow. Free speech on campus, a lawsuit now. Yay, this could go on for how long? I mean, what do you make of it, Andy Chow?
Well, this is just kind of the thing that's going on nationwide is Richard Spencer and his group of white nationalists just want to go to different college campuses and spread what they want to spread their message around. And so we've seen college campuses fight back. We've seen like in Charlottesville where a massive protest formed and violence erupted and somebody died. So I think the big debate here is you want to foster free speech, but you also want to protect people from violence, and you have to also prepare safety and security for these types of things. And I think where they left off before Friday was that OSU maybe came back to Richard Spencer and his group with some sort of trying to make some sort of compromise happen. And I'm not sure how that landed, but I think the big thing is that OSU says that they don't really know how to make the campus safe from a Richard Spencer event.
Hmm. Well, and back, you know, when we covered the State House, it was the Klan speaking on the right. State House grounds and kind of the same debate. And as I recall, the Klan has spoke from the, I think it's the north side steps for whatever reason.
Yes, I think you're right.
They were up there spewing their hate, and the crowd was spewing noises of whatever they could make as loud as they could. So it was just sort of an hour-long shouting match between sides. And I guess everyone had their free speech and went home. And a huge police presence, state troopers lined up kind of between them with a fence and everything. And I don't know if everyone went home happy, everyone went home mad or whatever, but it's one of the dilemmas in a country whether we treasure our First Amendment, but you know, and college campuses are interestingly more and more involved in this whole freedom of speech.
There's supposed to be bastions of free speech, and I've talked to people, college students, and that kind of thing, who say, "Well, not if it's hate speech." Well, yeah, sorry, you don't get in our country. You don't get to pick the kind of speech.
And both Ohio State and University of Cincinnati are public universities. So right. This is public ground and space. And I think it's my understanding Ohio State said that the date that Mr. Spencer proposed was not – it was going to be a problem for safety reasons, but maybe they could try to find another alternative. It's kind of where they left
it. Why it's a problem for safety reasons?
You know, because I'm from the Cincinnati Inquirer, we covered UC's decision right. a little bit closer. And yeah. I know it, for UC's part, they said, you know, he could come and speak. And there are already large numbers of activists and community leaders who've said, you know, whenever he's here, we'll be there to counter protest him. And so that's the tack they've taken there.
I think there are a couple of things that happen when somebody like Richard Spencer wants to go to a college campus, because a big part of the messaging, from what I can gather from the white nationalist groups, is that they have one of their big rhetoric is that they want people to think that a college campus is nothing but a bunch of left-wing, liberal, progressive people who want to force their agenda on young minds. And so meaning free speech is not welcome at college campuses and you can't be anything but liberal on college campuses. Mm-hmm. That's what the Richard Spencer group says. Mm-hmm. And so when something like this happens, it kind of just fuels their agenda. If mm-hmm. it fuels something like Richard Spencer's agenda, then they can go online and constantly promote. See, a big university like Ohio State does not allow free speech. It works to their advantage. I don't want to assume too much, but it seems like this is what they want. They want to be shut out so that they can say, look, we're right. College campuses do not allow free speech if it's not the speech that they agree with.
And I think this is also a certain portion of the conservative movement per se. Like, for example, the Hamilton County Republican Party chairman, Alex Triantafylou, went to Twitter and said, you know, Richard Spencer's appearance doing the near impossible, uniting all of us against his vile rhetoric. He is not conservative. Mm-hmm. So at least Republicans in Cincinnati are trying to make it clear that he doesn't represent them.
No question in my mind about that. Not to be conflated with the Republican Party or mm-hmm. anything like that. Two Ohio House Republicans in August introduced the Campus Free Speech Act. And do you guys know anything about that or what's happened with that?
So I'm not actually sure how far it went, but basically the concept would be they wanted to have more access for student groups in order, and I think more remedies if student groups were not allowed to, you know, provide their particular speaker or viewpoint. All of the groups that were at the Prefs conference were of a more conservative slant. And mm-hmm. part of the message from that, like to Andy's point, was there is some concern among conservatives that universities are too liberal and not as welcoming to conservative viewpoints.
And I would say it's more about loosening restrictions that already exist on college campuses. So, for example, I think at OSU there is a rule that you can't hang up any type of flag. I think there are just things that you can't, you know, how people at their campus
like
houses
emblems that kind of thing.
And
yeah.
you just can't hang up stuff
unless
that,
it's an Ohio State flag.
I'm you know, maybe if it's an Ohio State flag, they can hang that. So representing some sort of idea or some sort of opinion by hanging something up in your dorm room window. And then there's also these so-called free speech zones where, yes, you can hand out literature, but only in a restricted space. And only I think at one of the universities, they say, yeah, you can hand out literature, but only right here. And those groups complain that there's not a lot of foot traffic in that free speech zone. So loosening restrictions like that.
Yeah, it's, you know, Republicans do want to distance themselves with extremes like white nationalism. At the same time, conservatives, I think, are frosted by what they view as inequities on campus and in the way they are treated, and that, you know, liberal groups get free rein and the politically correct culture, you know, the things or, you know, the snowflakes. It's okay if it's a left sympathizing cause or someone injured, but if it's a right sympathizing cause or someone on the right's injured, well, that's just too bad. Now, again, I'm stating what I think is their perspective.
And has been for a long time.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's something the Republicans have to wrestle with, because there are those who would draw that straight line continuum from that sort of philosophy to what Mr. Spencer is saying and say, well, yeah, It's all this alt-right or whatever generalization you want to throw on it. Universities have a challenge because is there any truth to this? And, you know, there's, you know, the safe zones where you're supposedly protected from free speech or whatever. It's like, wow. And, you know, what isn't this all part of the education process? You're going to be, subject to competing ideas, some of them stated quite vociferously. Nobody wants violence. Everyone wants free speech, or at least we say we do. But, boy, there's just a blend. And college campuses are on the front lines of this. It's
free
a lot of tough
decisions.
Free speech
isn't free, people. Brian in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Ann. This talk about this gentleman, and I went to college out in Utah Valley University, and many years ago we had Michael Moore come out right after his 9/11 documentary came out. And in Utah County, probably the most conservative county in Utah, we had great backlash because Michael Moore was considered very controversial, and there was talk about polling funding or reducing our funding at the state college because tuition money was being used. But it was kind of weird because in the same year we brought Moore out, we had also brought out Peter Gergen, who was, an aide to multiple different presidents. And we were just trying to bring in ranges of different speakers. Mm-hmm. So to combat this really horrible person in the view of the Republican Party, we actually brought out Sean Hannity as a way to appease, the conservative folks. But, looking back at it, and we had protesters come out on both sides when both speakers came. Mm-hmm. And here we are some 12 years later, and it's just I have to laugh at how we thought that was such a huge deal, bringing out Michael Moore and Sean Hannity and how controversial they were at that time, mm-hmm. and how far the pendulum has swung to now we're seeing truly radical speakers come out to college campuses. And it just makes me, blows my mind. But I just thought I'd share that comment with you and my personal experience from my time in college.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Brian, thanks a lot for the call. It's all relative, I guess. I mean, back in the day, although I think Sean Hannity had probably raised a few hackles in some people.
You want to talk ancient history over 40 years ago. And then, when I was at college, this is my Case Western Reserve stint. There was a scientist brought in. I mean, true scientists had degrees in teaching and all that, but had a theory that, as I recall, minority people were genetically inferior. Mm-hmm. This is what he claimed his studies showed. So I don't even know who brought him in, but he was speaking at the university and it was a packed house, but most of the people had whistles, like referee's whistles. And every time he tried to speak, they blew the whistle. So there was kind of no free speech that night. But again, so do you allow someone like that? Do you allow a flat earther, the microphone? Do you bring him on the show, Ann? Mm-hmm. This kind of hits home with all of us. Do we put him in the paper? Jesse and Andy, do you give them some love in the media on this? So, hey, we kind of like that First Amendment stuff in our professions as well. It's not necessarily an easy question.
No, it's not. And I guess it's in the eye of the beholder as well.
Well, and I think the tough thing about what the story Daryl just mentioned, the story that Brian just mentioned, I mean, I don't know exactly what happened in that Utah situation, but I'm guessing nobody died. And there have been body counts where Richard Spencer has been. And I think that's where the rub is, where somebody has actually died at one of these events. And so college campuses need to figure out, well, are we going to be able to provide security for this? Or is this one of those, yes, free speech is free, but you can't yell fire in a movie theater? And I think that's what people are trying to figure out. And I think it's just all new, where I think a lot of people are trying to figure out how can you maintain free speech but still protecting people.
Let's move on. Let's take a break, and we'll continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is Weekly Reporter Roundtable, and still with us is Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, Jesse Balmer of the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Andy Chow, the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We're talking about free speech on campus. White nationalist Richard Spencer wants to speak on the Ohio campus, Ohio State campus, and so far they haven't come to an agreement over this issue. In the meantime, he has filed a lawsuit, filed the papers for a lawsuit, protesting Ohio State's inability to come make a decision. Apparently, they have, on the other hand, decided at the University of Cincinnati that they will have Spencer on campus. The Ohio State has said that they don't know if they can protect him. They can't, you know, guarantee public safety. And, you know, there's some people who just say, well, you know what? You can't guarantee everything. Mm-hmm. There are, the, you know, the free speech isn't free. So let's see here. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good. You know, you're framing this as a free speech issue, and I disagree in this regard.
Okay.
Richard Spencer is going to campuses and imposing his – he's not being invited – he's going to campuses and saying, I am going to come to your campus and I'm going to make this speech. And it's not free speech in this regard. I'm paying tuition for my student, for my daughter to go to school here.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he's doing is he's imposing his, I think, vile views on folks who have no interest in hearing it. It's the same as if I go to your house, I can't go and walk into your house and say, Ann, this is how I feel about this. That's not free speech as far as I'm concerned.
All right, Mike. I get where you're coming from, but it's a public university. They're both public universities. Who gets to decide what's vile or not? And I get the vile reference, but who's to decide ultimately what's vile?
Well, basically, I guess it comes down to this. Is it okay for anyone with any specific issue, no, regardless of how decadent or how terrible it is, to impose their will, come in and say, I am going to go, you give me a platform. Mm-hmm. See, there are lots of different people that we don't give platforms to. There are lots of different kinds of issues that we don't give platforms to. And I think that therein lies the issue. The gentleman from Utah talked about Michael Moore and Sean Hannity.
Mm-hmm.
They were invited to that campus. Richard Spencer is going around to campuses and saying, you will allow me. You must allow me to go and do these speeches. No one is inviting him to do these things.
Andy Chow, Mike, hang on a second. Andy Chow?
Well, I guess I think that I just want to clarify something. I don't think that he's going to go into a class or anything. I think he's using whatever public venue is. He might just be outside, you know? So it's not a specific class instruction or anything like that. It's
you don't
just
have to go,
right? Yeah, and I think with the Michael Moore thing, so he was invited, like he said.
Mm-hmm.
But this is kind of just more of a he's going to access whatever public venue is open to him, and then like Mike's saying, then he'll be able to say what he wants to say.
Mike, I got a lot of other calls to get to, but thank you so much for your call. Now we have Chris in Granville. Hi, Chris.
Hi. There was a reference earlier to a professor who got whistled down at a college. It was a speaker. His name was Charles Murphy, and the book was The Bell Curve that allegedly showed that there was a difference in the intelligence between white and blacks,
mm-hmm.
but that the variation between people within each of those groups was such that the small difference that existed was meaningless given the variation in the entire within group population.
Okay, and I know, but you know what, Chris, I don't want to get off on a tangent debating that particular topic. What we're talking about right now is speech on campus.
I was just that it ruined his career kind of unfairly, I think, because we never got a full public hearing of his ideas, so it was a chilling effect on free speech.
Okay, I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Good point. Thank you. Gary in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Gary.
Yes. Hello, Ann. I have a good question. Frankly, I think the United States should outlaw hate speech just like Germany did after World War II. Solve a lot of problems for us.
I don't want to create too much of a hot button, but I would say that there are a lot of people out there who believe that what people from Black Lives Matter say is hate speech. So who's going to decide what hate speech is?
Again, there's that slippery slope. Jesse?
Yeah, I was going to say the challenge is what is hate speech and what is vile speech and what is something that has no instructional value and what has something that has instructional value and who decides. That's the challenge you get into with free speech issues.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we want to keep our First Amendment rights the way they are and you know, hash them out like we are today.
Mm-hmm.
Let me throw in that, you know, you only have a few calls now. Let's get a whole bunch more. What about, you talk about free speech rights. What about President Trump wanting to take the licenses away of TV stations?
Even though they don't exist, but yeah.
Well, FCC.
Yeah, but those are local stations. He wanted to take away NBC's network license, and there's no such thing. It's a network. But,
well,
yeah,
even
point taken.
The intent, and it's kind of Nixonian. Mm-hmm. Not kind of, it is. It's exactly what Richard Nixon wanted to do as well. But again, because the president disagrees with him, well, does that earn them condemnation? Should some action be taken? Is that what we want in this country?
Steve in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Molly Ivins years ago talked about when the KKK marched in Austin, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
She said along the route as they marched, they were mooned.
Mm-hmm.
And she said it was kind of like watching the wave at a football game.
Oh, gosh. Good old Molly Ivins. Thank you, Steve. Yeah, I mean, this is...
Thanks for the levity, Steve.
She had a way with words, that's for sure.
I will not get that out of my mind the rest of the day
now.
Yeah,
I know, but, you know, we're going to be talking about this speech on campus, free speech on college campuses later in the week in more detail. And I hope everyone who wants to join in that conversation will join us then. I think it's tomorrow. It's tomorrow. Sorry. It's tomorrow. So and that would be at 10 o'clock. So the first hour of the show. So why don't you join us then if you can check it out, because we'll drill down a little deeper with experts on speech rights, with legal experts, that kind of a thing, because we're not Germany. I mean, it's just different. And we have a different history here in the United States that we grapple with every single day. Let's turn to the Republican race for governor. It's taken a nasty turn. When I say Republican race, that means the Republican primary race. Again, by the way, everybody, it's not until next year. Fear not.
May 8th.
But they are revving their engines at the starting gate. That's for sure. Yeah. Well, it's gone beyond that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're. Well, tell us, Andy.
Just a recap, Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, Attorney General Mike DeWine, Secretary of State John Husted, and Congressman Jim Renacci. Those are the four people running for a Republican Party nomination. So right now, I would say the biggest drama is coming between Secretary of State John Husted and Congressman Jim Renacci.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Renacci is just constantly targeting Husted with negative advertising. He's had volunteers or pseudo campaign workers come out with, you know, social media memes that seem to be threatening with John Husted in a threatening position. He seemed like he was tied up with a duct tape around his mouth. So just really, really tense rhetoric between Husted and Renacci, mostly coming from the Renacci side. The thing that I find really interesting is neither of these two are the perceived front runner in the race. Mike DeWine seems like he's the front runner in this race, yet these two are kind of going at it below him while DeWine might be skating up top for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yeah, there was also this like kerfuffle, if you will, after the GOP forum about a week ago. And essentially, Jim Renacci, the congressman's wife, went to talk with John Husted after the event because everybody during the event had promised to run a campaign that is above board and, you know, respectful of those in the race. And so she wanted to approach him and say, you know, like, I don't think you're running an above board race.
She just couldn't
kind
help
of paraphrase
herself, huh?
per se. And so the Renacci campaign says that Husted was
threatening or something, right?
Not physically threatening, but perhaps verbally threatening in that case. I personally wasn't there, so we're getting a lot of this kind of secondhand. But certainly there is a lot of back and forth between those two. And also, for what it's worth, the volunteer who was posting the inappropriate things, first she posted on the Facebook wall of a John Husted PAC employee, and the employee was writing about her relative's recent death. And so this Renacci volunteer thought this would be a good venue to chat about how much she dislikes John Husted and his policies. So she has since been dismissed, fired, what have you, from the campaign. She also was a big supporter of President Trump in Southwest Ohio. So kind of a person that we in Cincinnati have known for interesting politics over the past couple months, several months.
Oh, okay. She's a known quantity then?
She's a bit of a known quantity.
Okay, okay.
And so it was interesting that Renacci, as the candidate who's kind of positioning himself as, you know, Trump's voters' pick, would also pick up this volunteer that had a bit of a problem comporting herself professionally in the past.
Yeah, this was weird because I talked with both Congressman Renacci and Secretary of State Husted after the event last Sunday night. Apparently, I wasn't in the right place at the right time, though.
I missed the story, Daryl.
Well, whatever. I was, you know, and talked with Attorney General DeWine as well.
Yeah.
This is a little bit hard to figure out. Now, first of all, there should be a distinction made between a lot of the stuff going from the Husted camp toward Renacci is coming from a super PAC. At least by law, that cannot be coordinated with the candidate. So at least in theory, at least legally, mm-hmm. John Husted cannot be approving or disapproving of whatever message his super PAC is delivering mm-hmm. in terms of Congressman Renacci or whatever. The other thing is it almost is like the early parts of the Republican presidential primary where everyone wanted to be the alternative to Trump. I mean, are we fighting here to be the alternative to DeWine? Because it really seems like Secretary Husted, Congressman Renacci are both fighting intensely for that conservative mantle. You look at John Husted's videos, and it's the John Husted that those of us who've covered him over the years have not really seen, you know, toting a gun and mm-hmm. talking about values and religion and things of that nature. Not saying he's changed or whatever. I'm just saying we haven't seen that publicly. So those two are going back and forth. Meanwhile, Mary Taylor is in the room and talking about how the Department of Taxation, which is in part of her administration, the Kasich Taylor administration, is treating small businesses like criminals.
Yes.
And we now this is one we were at the heart of because Monday, a week ago today, which unfortunately was a holiday, we said, do tell. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we wanted to back it up. Mm-hmm. Or wanted them to, you know, show us your evidence. Well, mm-hmm. whatever you say, you know, we'll judge it and put it in the paper. They said, okay, well, it'll take you a couple of days. Well, and the next day, everyone's back at work. The governor's office is not happy with this characterization. Obviously, the Department of Taxation alleges she doesn't know what she's talking about. And Lieutenant Governor Taylor says, no, we're not giving you any more evidence. It's just going to have to stand anecdotally. So we write that as a story. In fact, it was our lead story in the Dispatch last Wednesday that mm-hmm. she refused to back it up. But then she starts tweeting about the story and offering, you know, says anyone who's dealt with this knows it's true. Interestingly, she cites the head of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, who does not like the Department of Taxation, but says the Lieutenant Governor's characterization of criminals is way over the top. She cites Keith Faber,
former Senate President,
saying, hey, he tried to get this law changed and the Department of Taxation was against it. And then Faber chimes in, yeah, that's true. See, they're anti-business, which again seems to be a step or two away from criminal behavior.
Yeah, right.
So this is hanging out there, and boy, I don't know if this is grounds for divorce now of the Kasich.
Well, I wondered. I mean, you said they were upset.
She's also whacking him on Obamacare.
Right.
I mean, which she has, but now it's just been very blatant.
But he's been pretty loyal to her.
I was going to say, keep in mind that for the most part, he has said that he would support Mary Taylor. I mean, he hasn't done a huge rollout endorsement, but he has said if he would pick, he would pick his own lieutenant governor who was by his side for the past two terms. Mm-hmm. You know, this is kind of in keeping with she also wants to basically undo what Kasich has done when it comes to health care and Medicaid expansion. So, I mean, she's definitely breaking away from her own administration here in a lot of ways. I think another interesting thing is she's been the head of a new organization under the Kasich-Taylor administration, which is called the Common Sense Initiative, where it's basically that Common Sense Initiative, or the CSI, is in charge of looking into new rules created and if it would impact businesses. Mm-hmm. So she's been on the front lines of helping create a better atmosphere for businesses in Ohio.
So it seems like she'd have evidence, though, or something more than anecdotal.
Yeah, or I would say I just think it's kind of a weird turn in messaging. I would think that being part of this Kasich administration, the NFIB has been supportive of this administration for the most part, too. So I think it's a weird turn to criticize the administration instead of leaning on its strengths, where people have been pretty happy with the business climate here.
Well, it's weird until you think about how is she going to – I mean, John Kasich's not well thought of among conservative Republicans in Ohio.
Exactly.
You look at that, across the country, for that matter. He's going to have a conversation with Joe Biden, of all people, later this week.
Yeah, exactly. I think – I mean, all four of the candidates – to one degree or another, distance themselves from Governor Kasich. Uh-huh. I mean, this is a two-term Republican governor whose, the last I saw, approval rating was still pretty high in Ohio. Mm-hmm. But guess what? We are in the era of Trump. Things are a little different now. So, which means the Republican electorate is different. Again, remember, we're not appealing just yet to a general election audience. These are the hardcore folks who vote in the Republican primary.
All right. By the way, what about the Democrats?
Who?
Yeah.
Yeah. We've got candidates out
there. Yeah, there are four of them. You have former Congresswoman Betty Sutton. You have Connie Pillich, who was a former state representative, also ran for treasurer against Josh Mandel in the last cycle. We have Senator Joe Schiavone, who was recently the top Democrat in the Senate, and then Data Mayor Nan Whaley. And then there are the perennial discussions about who might get into the race, such as Rich Cordray, who used to be the former attorney general and now runs the
Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Oh, you're just showing off now.
So we got them. You know, Jerry Springer, former Cincinnati mayor, has been rumored to be thinking it over, at least. And Dennis Kucinich has been... confusing emails about it. So so I think my biggest frustration.
Did you say Bill O'Neill?
What?
Did you say Bill O'Neill?
Yeah.
Oh, Bill O'Neill.
The state Supreme Court justice that says he might now join again. So
someone better doesn't come along kind
right.
of a thing. Yeah.
And I think part of the challenge for Democrats on that is the unions, which are a big source of money and organization for Democrats, are not putting their picks down because they don't necessarily know who's all getting in the race. And I think that hurts Democrats running for governor, especially when three of the Republicans have about 4 million on hand.
This will continue to percolate, and we'll continue to talk about all of it. Jesse Balmert, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's Jesse Balmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Andy Chow, thanks to you as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Daryl Rowland, thank you for coming in today.
On the road again.
Daryl Rowland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks to everybody else for listening. Remember, we're going to be talking about the speech on campus issue tomorrow during hour one. So join us then. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.